This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Growing the job market for everybody who was going to be educated to the point where you are now finding that most of university graduates are getting a street. So education was expanded, the economy was not.
That's Professor Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio, sharing his thoughts regarding the bleak economic outlook of Zimbabwe. Details coming up. Also, a drone strike appears to have killed civilians caught in the conflict in Ethiopia's Amhara region. And Niger's coup leaders say they will prosecute President Mohamed Bazoum for treason. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Health workers say at least 26 civilians were killed in a drone strike in a town in Ethiopia's Amhara region. Federal government forces and a regional militia that fought on the same side during the recent war in the Tigray region have been fighting each other for the past 4 months, as Maya Misikir reports from the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa.
The attack Sunday took place in the central town of Fenota Salam in the West Gorjam zone of Ethiopia's Amhara region. A doctor at Fenota Salam Hospital, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, said injured people started arriving around midday. He says there are many people who died at the site of the accident, but we do not have the exact numbers of that. But the ones who arrived here and passed away are around 26 people as of now. Amhara militia known as FANO fought alongside federal troops against Tigrayan forces during the two-year war that ended last November in the Tigray region. Fighting between the federal government and FANO was sparked in April when the government ordered the militia to integrate with the country's police or military following the peace deal in Tigray. Essential supplies for saving lives, including oxygen tanks, have been running short due to roadblocks in the area, according to health workers in Fenota Salam. The doctor says the hospital struggled to deal with the wounded from the drone strike. He says the hospital did not have the capacity to handle even the ones who came yesterday. There were more than 100 injured people who came in at the beginning, and many more after that. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, in a statement released Monday, said that it received credible reports of shelling in Fenota Salam, as well as two other locations in Amhara region, Bure and Debre Berhan. The commission also said that civilians were subject to beatings and killings in many areas of Bahrdar, the capital city of Amhara region. The Ethiopian government announced the arrest of 23 individuals in relation to what it called illegal activities last Friday, 10 days after declaring a state of emergency in Amhara. Among those arrested were an opposition parliamentarian, Christian Tadella, and the editor-in-chief of the online news outlet Alpha Media, Bekalu Alamero. Maya Misikir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The military junta that deposed Niger President Mohamed Bazoum last month says they may put Bazoum on trial for high treason. The statement comes days after neighboring West African countries known as ECOWAS issued a deadline for the coup leaders to reinstate Bazoum, which came and went, and an announcement late last week that the group was raiding a standby force for Niger. Author J. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that all sides need to de-escalate the rhetoric, and ECOWAS and the West must figure what it can and cannot do and at what cost.
It's not helpful that the rhetoric has escalated. You know, a cardinal rule of diplomacy is you never make a threat unless you are prepared to carry it out. Another cardinal rule is deadlines have to be realistic, and they cannot be set up in such a way as to be self-defeating. And unfortunately, ECOWAS has violated both of these key principles of diplomacy. First, the deadline was set way too long, a week, which gave the junta time to entrench itself, deal with, smooth over any dissent within the military ranks, and in fact, win a lot of the population to its side. So they probably shouldn't have set a deadline that far ahead. Then having set the deadline, they should have been more realistic about what they could or could not deliver. And I know there's been the promise at the summit last week that they would raise a standby force, it should have been ready already, but a standby force of 5,000 with no indication of where they were coming from, when they were coming together, and to what end, even if 5,000 were sufficient. And I say this with a bit of experience. When I was special envoy of the U.S. for the Sahel, just before I was appointed, ECOWAS made a grand announcement in the end of 2019. Beginning of 2020, they actually briefed it to the UN Security Council that the regional body was standing up on its own, self-funded, $1 billion anti-terrorism joint force that by 2024 was going to eliminate terrorism in the region. This force has yet to materialize, and we are in 2023. So forgive me a bit of skepticism about what kind of force they're going to raise quickly.
You do sound skeptical. What kind of force would you envision? What would make a difference for this kind of force to actually make a concrete difference?
Well, to be quite frank, if you're going to reverse a coup, it has to occur in what my friend, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for West African Affairs, Todd Moss, called the golden hour. There's a narrow window right after a coup when it might be possible to reverse it. That window has long since closed. It's very, very difficult for an outside force to come in a situation like this, unless there's support within the country for that force. Otherwise, you're talking about an actual invasion. And classic military doctrine says that an invader requires three times the force of the defender if there's even a chance of success. Niger has 25,000 troops, some of whom are very, very well trained by the U.S., France, and others in as special forces for counterterrorism operations. That requires, assuming that all 25,000 were not present, let's just say dealing with just Niamey, let's say a fifth of the Nigerian forces were available, that still would require 15,000, which is not a number ECOWAS is talking about. So they haven't presented a realistic plan or how they're going to go about this. And there's always risk in these types of operations, risks that someone could get hurt, especially prisoners like President Bazoum or some of his ministers. That risk is there when experienced forces like the U.S. Navy SEALs, British SAS, French Special Forces do it. And we're not dealing with that level of professionalism here.
You laid out in your piece last week about some things that can be done. What do you see happening from this point forward?
Well, I think going forward, one has to figure a way to de-escalate. The rhetoric on both sides needs to go down, whether it be charging the former president, deposed president with treason or war across the Sahel. That's not helpful. Let's de-escalate and let's look at reality. And the reality is we have to try to somehow prevent the situation. It's in everyone's interest that the situation in the Sahel does not get worse, that extremist groups do not have an opening to roll back some of the gains. Niger has managed to increase security. Violence this year is at the lowest level since 2018. Certain development goals have been achieved. IDPs, internally displaced persons, are beginning to be resettled. We have to preserve some of those gains.
That's Ambassador J.P. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme in Washington this past hour. Attacks by Sudanese paramilitaries on Sunday sent hundreds of civilians fleeing in the western province of Darfur as battles against the regular army intensify in region. One resident told the French news agency AFP that hundreds of people have been displaced from Nayala, the capital of South Darfur state. In a televised speech today, the head of Sudan's military, General Abdel Fattah Burhan, accused the rival Rapid Support Forces of committing war crimes. The Associated Press reports he accused the head of the RSF, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, of promising to bring about democracy by committing war crimes. UN officials say the conflict has morphed into ethnic violence in Darfur, with the RSF and allied Arab militias targeting African communities there. The Associated Press says last week the violence intensified in South Darfur province, killing dozens. Last month, Karim Kahan, a prosecutor from the International Criminal Court, told the United Nations that he will investigate alleged new war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur. The weak health of Zimbabwe's economy is at the center of the debate in the national elections on August 23rd. Business professor Elliot Masote, professor of business at Devry University in Ohio, says the ZANU-PF party, which has governed since liberation in 1980, made positive changes early on but has not been able to boost the economy.
Yes, Zimbabwe's economy has been in bad shape for a very long time. We know the former president was in power for, you know, 40 years, for about 40 years. And, you know, some of the policies they introduced, you know, opening up education to everybody, make primary school education compulsory to everybody, it was great. But then they did not actually in factories, growing the job market for everybody who was going to be educated, to the point where you are now finding that most of university graduates are getting the streets. So education was expanded, the economy was not. So now they are trying to introduce education 5.0 that helps people coming from universities to be able to form their own jobs right now. And then, you know, the idea of land distribution that happened in the late 90s, that puts Zimbabwe in a very bad shape as a country that was the breadbasket of Southern Africa. And then they took land from commercial white farmers, and some of them left for Nigeria, for Zambia. And those people who were given farms, even the former president, acknowledged that they made a mistake. So the economy was going down and down and down. And again, without any formal planning, Zimbabwe joined the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that was the turning point of the Zimbabwean dollar losing value big time. You know, the government was printing money without any backup.
It's funny you mentioned the white farmers being evicted from their lands. But very recently, Zimbabwe said foreign citizens who had their land seized could now apply to get it back.
I don't think it's going to solve the problem right now. I know there is compensation of those white commercial farmers who lost their land, but that compensation is going to be in monetary forms rather than them getting back their land and then start all over again to kick people out who have already invested a lot in that land they got from the government after the government had taken that land from white commercial farmers. So my understanding is that they have been in negotiations, and the former president of Tanzania, Mr. Joachim Chissano, was at the center of it and agreed that, well, we're going to compensate white commercial farmers in terms of money. I don't know if they're going to get their land back. That is not going to be possible because, you know, the land distribution was included in the constitution to be non-reversible at all. So currently, local commercial farmers, they're beginning to learn how to farm commercially different types of crops, but it should take years for us to get to where we were with the white commercial farmers farming for the country and the whole of Southern Africa, because our local farmers don't have enough equipment. They don't have enough knowledge, skills, and experience to commercially farm and support the country. But they are trying, and the argument of the government was that, you know, those white commercial farmers who lost land, they did not come to Zimbabwe to farm, to Rhodesia to farm with all the education, skill, and experience. They learned it here. So our local black farmers are going to do the same. They got land without education, skills, and experience, and they are in the process of learning exactly the same process as former colonial farmers did. But I think we are getting there where we can feed ourselves as Zimbabweans, but it's going to take time for us to export as we used to do to feed the whole of Southern Africa and beyond.
That was Professor Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in Ohio. He spoke with me from Harare. We'll have more of that interview in tomorrow's show. Be sure to tune in or catch it on voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe is celebrating its Heroes Day today, a day to honor the lives and sacrifices of those who fought in the liberation struggle over four decades ago. Reporter Kuzaza Nwashi looks at what constitutes a hero to young people in Zimbabwe.
Patience Piri is a creative entrepreneur in Zimbabwe. She says the idea of a hero in Zimbabwe is evolving.
Where we've come from as a people and where we are going, there are changes. Before, we used to think heroes were just people that went to war and fought it out with guns.
Tapiwa Nashe Chiriga is an advocacy officer with a local peace-building non-profit organization called Heal Zimbabwe.
This year, we at Heal Zimbabwe Trust are celebrating the unheralded heroes and heroines who've taken it upon themselves in very difficult circumstances in communities, building tolerance, peace, and social cohesion. They have taken small, yet brave and great strides towards a peaceful and tolerant Zimbabwe, which is also inclusive.
Piri explains her outlook on modern-day heroes in Zimbabwe.
The difference for me is that heroes are community champions, are people that are doing things that will make us better, people that are doing things on the ground, not just talking about it. And these are young people. These are artists. These are nurses. These are teachers. These are farmers. This is everyone, anyone who's contributing. To me, that person is a hero.
Both Piri and Chiriga agree that the definition of a hero or heroine in Zimbabwe is evolving to keep up with the current situation here. Piri says, at a community level, there should be efforts to celebrate everyday heroes while they are still alive, instead of just tributes that are often offered when someone has passed on. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
The coup in Niger, the war in Sudan, aid for Syrians. VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir has more on the top stories at the United Nations in her weekly roundup.
The West African regional group ECOWAS said Thursday it had activated its standby military force after a deadline had passed for Niger's military coup leaders to reverse their actions and reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum.
The Secretary General is very concerned over the deplorable living conditions that President Bazoum and his family are reported to be living under, as they continue to be arbitrarily detained by members of the presidential guard in Niger. The Secretary General reiterates his concern over the health and safety of the president and his family, and once again calls for his immediate, unconditional release and his reinstatement as head of state.
In Sudan, the first humanitarian convoy reached East Darfur since the start of the conflict in mid-April. The situation in Darfur has dramatically deteriorated since fighting began between rival generals. The UN Security Council met Wednesday to discuss the violence.
The longer this war continues, the greater the risk of fragmentation and foreign interference and erosion of sovereignty and the loss of Sudan's future, particularly its youth.
In another development, Syria agreed to allow the UN to continue using three border crossings from Turkey to reach 4 million people living beyond government control in northwest Syria for up to 6 months. Looking ahead to next week, the Security Council plans to hold a rare public meeting Thursday on the human rights situation in North Korea.
Protecting people around the world is an integral part of the UN Charter and an important responsibility of the Security Council. And that means holding the DPRK regime accountable for its human rights abuses and violations.
The U.S., Japan, South Korea, and Albania requested the session. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Cameroon's government and humanitarian agencies are distributing emergency food to millions of people facing hunger along the country's northern borders with Chad and Nigeria. Authorities blame natural disasters, long-running local conflicts, and Russia's war in Ukraine for causing food shortages. Mokidwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Aid groups and the government of Cameroon say they distributed rice, millet, and beans to at least 30,000 people this week along the Central African state's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Refugee populations and host communities are among the recipients. The government and relief agencies now aim to reach a total of 4 million people over the next 6 weeks. Distribution is complicated by torn-up roads and ongoing clashes between government troops and separatist groups in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions. Aid agencies have also reported sporadic Boko Haram attacks, but the government has said it will protect all aid workers. Ayisi Numa is the coordinator of the Emergency Food Project at the Cameroon Red Cross, one of the agencies distributing food aid. Numa says undernourishment, famine, movements of people out of their communities in search of food in Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria are the direct consequences of severe floods and attacks by elephants and migratory birds on plantations. Numa says Boko Haram terrorism and clashes between herders and fishers that displaced more than 100,000 people, including farmers, to Chad, are some of the causes of the present food shortages. Numa spoke on Cameroon state broadcaster CRTV on Friday. The separatist crisis in the west and Boko Haram attacks in the north have disrupted food production and left millions of Cameroonians facing hunger in recent years. Russia's invasion of Ukraine made the situation worse. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. More recently, floods that swept through towns including the economic hub Douala and Boya and Limbe, both English-speaking western towns, also rendered several hundred homeless and hungry, the government says. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. Gabriel Mbairopi is Cameroon's agriculture minister. He says climate shocks added to the present food shortage Cameroon is witnessing.
Agro-pastoral production has been disrupted due to climate hazards, high rainfall in the northern part of the country, sudden cessation of rains in the southern part, which did not allow crops to complete their cycle, crop pests, and destruction of fields by pachyderm and socio-political and inter-community conflicts, affecting 27,000 producers.
Mbairopi says Cameroon's government and its partners are fully engaged to provide emergency food and nutritional supplies to all civilians threatened by hunger and disease. He said, besides distributing food aid, Cameroon is providing hybrid seeds and fertilizers to farmers who agree to return to their farms. The government says it has also distributed drought-tolerant crops to several thousand farmers on Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Meanwhile, Cameroon's livestock ministry reports that several hundred heifers, which quickly adapt to harsh climatic conditions and produce more milk than the local breed of cattle, have been distributed to herders in the area. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.